During some of our darker periods of American history, when slavery was legal, slave owners felt they had the right to do anything they wanted with their slaves since they were their property. They believed with a passion that the abolitionists were interfering in matters that did not concern them, and they saw no reason why they could not sexually abuse their slaves, beat them, torture them, even kill them at will. But in spite of the concept of one human owning another, being so fundamentally despicable and immoral, we were one of the last nations to abolish slavery. It is not difficult to see why it took the United States so long to join other civilized nations in ridding ourselves of this atrocity. Slave labor was essential to the financial well-being of our fledgling nation, and without it, our struggle for recognition and economic power would probably have had a different outcome. Since the Bible admonishes slaves to be obedient to their masters, slave owners felt that there was a biblical stamp of approval for their activities, which allowed them to live with their guilt. The fact that people willfully broke up families simply for economic gain shows how easily we humans can ignore and justify indescribable inhumanity to our fellow man when we stand to benefit personally. Of course, some slave owners treated their slaves with some degree of respect and even love. Such individuals were in turn respected and loved by their slaves. Such a relationship in no way justifies the institution of slavery, but simply points out a multiplicity of complex relationships. Not all Americans were in favor of slavery. In fact, the opposition by some was so strong that it threatened to destroy the fragile union that existed between the original 13 colonies. This sentiment was strongly voiced in the delegates' discourse in 1787 during the convention in Philadelphia called to revise the Articles of Confederation. Abolitionists, led by the Quakers, were relentless in their calls for doing away with slavery. After intense and rancorous debates, representatives from the smaller states and larger states finally agreed on a compromise. They would allow the slave states to join the Union, but slaves would only be counted as 3/5 of a person for the purposes of establishing the appropriate number of representatives for each state. This was also supposed to be a temporary situation, and there was a general understanding in the Union that slavery would soon be abolished because it was both immoral and inconsistent with the concept of a nation for, of, and by the people. Nevertheless, slavery continued for another 3/4 of a century, accompanied by untold atrocities, including vicious rapes and murders. Immorality was widespread no matter how you looked at it. I don't think many question whether slavery was immoral or not. Obviously it was. But does that mean we continue to tip the scales the other way forever because of mistakes that were made more than a century ago? Certain individuals feel that the United States cannot be forgiven for slavery until reparations are made to the descendants of slaves. This belief goes back to Mosaic laws requiring anyone who caused harm to someone else to make reparations to that individual or to the family if the injured individual was dead. There certainly is precedence for reparations in America. Many Native American tribes whose ancestors were deprived of land and resources were given sweetheart deals by our government, which now allows them to own some of the largest and most lucrative gambling casinos in the world. Many years ago, I was asked to speak at an all-tribe graduation for a large group of Native Americans who owned a massive gambling casino complex. Elders of the tribe told me that they were hoping that I could inspire many of the unmotivated young people to attend college, which the tribe would happily pay for. Since the tribe had so much money, many of the teenagers were happy to drive around in their BMWs and party instead of taking advantage of educational opportunities that would ensure a positive future for the tribe. The reparations the tribe had received were certainly justified given the tremendous losses suffered by Native Americans at the hands of American settlers. But I'm not entirely certain that the end result benefited the tribe as it could have. I can also understand the idea of reparations for the Japanese American families who were unjustly interned during World War II. In that case, corrective action was taken at a time when many of the victims could actually benefit from it. In the case of slavery, however, there are neither slaves nor slave owners currently living. So it seems unfair to require people who had nothing to do with slavery to pay for it. I understand the argument that the descendants of slave owners inherited property and large sums of money accumulated through slave labor and are thus obligated to share the proceeds with the descendants of slaves. There is some legitimacy to such an argument, but no one can really quantify the percentage of assets derived from slave labor in order to distribute them. Furthermore, where do you draw the line for reparations in the past? If you kept going back, you would soon be predating the existence of the United States, Europe, Asia, and Africa. Obviously, it is unfair to arbitrarily pick a date or event and say that reparations should commence from that point forward. As Proverbs 17:9 reminds us, peace is more likely when one forgets about past wrongs as opposed to reminding others of them. And if we all concentrate on building on the opportunities that exist and creating a more motivating environment to encourage individuals to achieve, the sky is the limit. If slavery had ended and everyone had been treated as equals from that point on, it might be easier to excuse the immorality that permitted hundreds of years of slavery in America. Unfortunately, slavery was followed by a system of sharecropping that exploited labor by former slaves, so that effectively, they were still slaves. Jim Crow laws also kept African Americans in a position of servitude both economically and socially. Fatal beatings and lynchings were commonplace throughout the South even into the 1970s. So on the issue of morality, with respect to treating one's fellow man fairly, I think we deserve a failing grade. That does not mean that things have not improved substantially over the last four decades. But four decades does not erase four centuries of brutal oppression. Even today, we exploit our fellow human beings for work. Is it moral for us, for example, to take advantage of cheap labor from illegal immigrants while denying them citizenship? I'm sure you can tell from the way I phrased the question that I believe we have taken the moral low road on this issue. Some segments of our economy would virtually collapse without these undocumented workers. We all know that. Yet, we continue to harass and deport many individuals who are simply seeking a better life for themselves and their families. Is there a way to apply logic to this issue and arrive at an intelligent solution? All we have to do is look to our northern neighbor, Canada. They have a guest worker program which allows people to enter the country as officially recognized guest workers who pay taxes, receive benefits, and are able to come and go as they please without infringing on anyone else's rights. They have the reassuring knowledge that they have contributed to the local economy while at the same time helping their families at home. Why is immigration such a difficult issue for us to deal with? I believe we are so tempted to play politics with this issue that both logic and morality have been thrown out of the window. What is a just war? What does the fact that we are so often involved in conflicts with other nations say about our morality? Since the inception of our nation, there have been very few extensive periods of peace. To approach the question another way, does an individual of high moral standing frequently find himself fighting with others? By bringing it down to an individual level, it is easier to see that the number of conflicts does not predict the level of morality. Instead, we need to first look at the reasons for the various wars before commenting on their morality. Most of our numerous conflicts could be justified based on our national interest, and even though there were always protesters to our wars, few conflicts were considered immoral until the Vietnam War came along. Many said that stopping communism spread was a noble goal and fully justified our involvement in this war. But others argued, with some validity, that we had no right to assume that our way of governing was superior to communism. As a student at Yale, I can remember these boisterous protests against the war, which echoed on college campuses across the nation. During that war, in the jungles of Vietnam, we burned villages with napalm and destroyed the lives of many innocent villagers who had nothing to do with the political struggle. The Viet Cong forces had the tremendous advantage of knowing both the terrain and the people, which eventually afforded them victory in the war. Even though we had overwhelming force, we had no way to deploy it in jungle terrain. Many of our soldiers were not clear about their overall mission, which surely had a negative effect on their enthusiasm. If communist forces had been trying to invade the United States, there would have been no question about the goals of the military and the country at large, and no sacrifice would have been too great in order to achieve victory. There also would have been no question about the morality of defending our way of life in our own country. Since the Vietnam conflict ended poorly, our nation experienced a period of shame and humiliation for which the military was blamed, and many of the returning veterans were treated with disrespect. The Vietnam War dampened America's enthusiasm for war, and we experienced one of the longest periods of peace in our nation's history. However, 16 years after the Vietnam War ended, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and the enthusiasm for military intervention was tremendous. After the successful conclusion of the effort to restore freedom to Kuwait, President George H.W. Bush and the military heroes enjoyed enormous popularity and approval. A war with well-defined and widely accepted goals that ends in victory will virtually always be seen as virtuous. The subsequent war with Iraq years later was much more controversial, especially after weapons of mass destruction were not found. Although a qualified victory was eventually scored, the opposition to it certainly rivaled that present during the Vietnam War. Whether the war in Iraq was moral or not is highly debatable. If you think stopping a brutal dictator from continuing to kill hundreds of thousands of his own people is worthwhile, then you are more likely to believe that we acted in a morally justifiable manner. If you're more concerned about the over 4,000 American lives that were lost and the hundreds of billions of dollars that were added to our national debt to be passed along to our children, then you're more likely to feel that our efforts were immoral. The point here is that it is very difficult to determine our nation's morality based on its military conflicts. Also, because we have dramatic changes of leadership and political philosophy, we do not have a consistent policy that governs military intervention. Then, too, one can legitimately ask the question, is any war moral? We try to sanitize wars by establishing all kinds of rules of conduct. Certainly, women and children should be spared, and torture should not be used, along with a myriad of other guidelines. If we followed this line of reasoning regarding prohibitions in war to its logical conclusion, I think the ultimate rule would say, no war, period. If you can establish arbitrary rules for war, then making one more rule that eliminates all war makes a lot of sense. Of course, by definition, wars tend to start when logical, reasoned diplomacy fails. Family values and education. It is hard to talk about the morality of a nation without considering the question of family values and the education of our youth. As we discussed in Chapter 4, our founding fathers placed great importance on educating future generations. I think with you, Benjamin Franklin once said, that nothing is of more importance for the public weal or welfare than to form and train up youth in wisdom and virtue. Wise and good men are, in my opinion, the strength of the state, more so than riches or arms. I think also that general virtue is more probably to be expected and obtained from the education of youth than from the exhortations of adult persons, bad habits and vices of the mind being, like diseases of the body, more easily prevented than cured. I think, moreover, that the talents for the education of youth are the gift of God, and that he on whom they are bestowed, whenever a way is opened for the use of them, is as strongly called as if he heard a voice from heaven. I believe one of the reasons our nation prospered was a strong emphasis on traditional family values that included instruction on the difference between right and wrong, teaching that began in the home and continued at school. And one of the central sources for defining values was the Bible, which back then was found in all public schools. Basic religious principles were taught in public schools in such a way as to have the broadest possible application without favoring any particular denomination. Children were taught that there was a Creator to whom they were responsible, and that there was a moral code given to us by the Creator to whom we would all have to answer in the afterlife. The Founding Fathers had much to say regarding the morality of our nation and how important it was to our future. But I think one of the best quotes that summarizes their feelings is from John Adams when he said, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." I fully recognize that many in our society would prefer not to derive their morality from the Bible and its teachings. Many such people are atheists or agnostics and claim to have their own internal moral compass. While their opinions diverge when it comes to sex outside of marriage, homosexuality, gambling, the use of illicit drugs and alcohol, and other social behavior, I find it interesting to note, however, that their moral compass points in very much the same direction as Judeo-Christian values when it comes to such issues as murder, lying, cheating, and theft. There is no question that the perspective over the last few decades regarding social morality has changed dramatically. When I was a child, it was generally considered shameful to have a child out of wedlock, whereas today, in many segments of our society, having a child out of wedlock is the norm, not in any way a sign of social stigma. Many people feel this indicates that we are progressing toward a more enlightened stage, and that we are less judgmental and more accepting of everyone. Although being open-minded and accepting is generally a good thing, we should examine the effects this change in attitude has on society as a whole. Children born out of wedlock are at least twice as likely to live in poverty as those born to a traditional family consisting of a married father and mother with a stable household income. Unwed mothers are also more likely to be high school or college dropouts and are more likely to be recipients of public welfare, frequently on a chronic basis. There is a greater incidence of sexually transmitted diseases in both unwed mothers and unwed fathers. Not only are these things deleterious to the affected children and parents, but they also place extra burdens on the rest of society, who has to pay the bills. And because someone else pays the bill, the behavior continues, and we feed an entitlement society with a voracious appetite for government funding. This brings us back to our point that what appears to be good in the short run, but is harmful in the long run, is in the end not virtuous and does not contribute to societal morality. A truly moral nation enacts policies that encourage personal responsibility and discourage self-destructive behavior by not subsidizing people who live irresponsibly and make poor choices. This can be done in a compassionate way, by phasing out government assistance for those already receiving it and making it clear that there will be no government assistance in the future in these situations. This is not to say that the affected individuals cannot be aided by their families, churches, and other charitable organizations and individuals. What we have just discussed may seem a bit harsh to many bleeding-heart do-gooders, but I submit that what is harsh is continuing to encourage irresponsible behavior and generating a permanent underclass. We also simply cannot afford welfare programs for able-bodied people who make unwise choices and expect other people to pay for it. An example of how responsible government policies can change a society's behavior is found in Sweden, where they decided in the 1990s that their nation's incidence of drunk driving was too high. They changed the legally tolerated blood alcohol limit from 0.05 to 0.02. In the United States, the average tolerated blood alcohol level is 0.08, four times higher than that in Sweden, and enacted and enforced severe penalties for drunk driving, including jail time, mandatory treatment, astronomical fines, and confiscation of one's vehicle. As a result, there was a dramatic decline in alcohol-related traffic accidents and fatalities. The behavioral changes are so enculturated that hardly anyone even considers driving if they have consumed a single can of beer. This shows that people do respond to appropriate legislative changes and that there is still great potential for our nation to use government in a responsible and uplifting manner that will not break the bank and that will encourage the development of responsible citizens who will be contributors rather than dependents. Fiscal responsibility, a hallmark of a moral government. In 2008, we saw the beginning of a gigantic financial crisis on Wall Street, with financial experts convincing both Republicans and Democrats that a financial tsunami would destroy the United States and the rest of the world if a gigantic government bailout did not occur immediately. So our government embarked upon a series of financial ventures to prop up companies and financial entities that were too big to fail. Whether it really worked or not is anybody's guess, and can never be proven one way or another. But one thing that did become clear was that there were many people involved in the financial markets who made enormous sums of money by engaging in questionable financial practices, while shareholders and constituents made little or nothing, or even lost great sums of money. Some of the tricks employed by money managers have been outlawed through wise legislative reforms enacted after the stock market crash in 1929 and the ensuing decade of turmoil. Congress recognized way back then that unless financial markets were regulated, greed would raise its ugly head and wreak havoc whenever human beings are involved. During the 1990s, however, Congress allowed significant deregulation of financial markets, perhaps expecting that human nature had changed. It took almost 20 years to prove that greed was still alive and well, and it almost destroyed our nation. The obvious question, given our subject matter, is, does a moral nation allow criminals who have defrauded the populace to get away without penalty? I have no problem with people making large sums of money legitimately, along with all the other people involved in whatever venture is generating the money. On the other hand, just because people control our market's financial instruments, they should not be able to personally benefit by manipulating those instruments to their advantage. Many of these people suffer from the same type of entitlement mentality seen in poor people who are always looking for a government handout. These Wall Street moguls and corporate executives actually think that what they do is worth hundreds of millions of dollars a year, even though, in many cases, they're simply moving money around, producing nothing. The jury is still out on whether our government will conduct a serious investigation into what manipulation, if any, lay behind this crisis and whether justice will be served. The Bible says that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. 1 Timothy 6:10. And with this basic principle in mind, one can easily see how a government that is in love with the people's money could engage in the evil act of bleeding the people. A truly virtuous government would act fiscally responsible, constantly remind itself of its duties, and collect just enough money through taxes to take care of those duties. It would never overspend its budget unless there was an emergency, in which case it would make every effort to pay back the debt as soon as possible. The United States government was very fiscally responsible up until World War II, after which time paying back the national debt became less of a priority. That debt has continued to grow and now is almost equal to our gross domestic product, GDP. An entire year's worth of our nation's production simply going to pay off debt. There are many politicians who say we have always lived with a large national debt, and that it is really just a number that doesn't mean anything. But the founders of our nation would be astonished, even outraged, to hear our leaders saying such things. Thomas Jefferson said, "We shall all consider ourselves unauthorized to saddle posterity with our debts, and morally bound to pay them ourselves, and consequently within what may be deemed the period of a generation or the life of the majority." One of the greatest responsibilities of parents is that of looking out for the future of their children. This is not only a duty, it is a moral obligation. The same is true of a nation and its progeny. To saddle the next generation with unimaginable debt is not only callous, it is morally reprehensible. How can we even live with ourselves, knowing that we are eroding the standard of living of the next generations with each dollar that we add to the national debt? As of this writing, a vigorous debate has taken place regarding the budget for the remainder of the fiscal year. The Republicans, driven by the new members of the Tea Party, wanted to cut $61 billion from the budget, while the Democrats were not willing to cut that amount. The president, not wanting to be accused of cutting entitlements, took a wait-and-see attitude rather than leading the charge toward fiscal responsibility. Subsequently, after a huge tug-of-war between the White House, the Republicans, and the Democrats, a new bipartisan supercommittee has been established to make over $1 trillion in budgeting cuts and stem the rise of our national debt. Perhaps they will be taken more seriously than was the Bowles-Simpson Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. Both Democrats and Republicans have strayed so far from the path of responsible financial policy that the concept of balancing the budget is foreign to them. I believe many of them simply cannot grasp the concept of only spending what you have. I do understand that making budgetary cuts will be painful, but it will not be nearly as painful as going bankrupt. One need only look at historic images of Hungarian Pengar bills being swept in the gutter in 1946, or of the Zimbabwe $100 trillion bill created in 2009 because of their rocketing hyperinflation to understand the gravity of the situation. Knowing how Washington works, I can already predict that our Democratic president and the rest of the Democratic Party will claim that the Republicans want to cut programs that benefit children, the elderly, and the infirm, and that they want to stifle medical research and programs that will create economic growth. The Republicans will claim that the Democrats are addicted to spending and couldn't stop if their lives depended on it. Applying logic to the situation, which may be too much to hope for given all the emotions flying around Washington, could go a long way toward resolving the problem without making it into a political football. I believe the logical approach would be to have each governmental agency and department trim its budget by 10%, with no exceptions. In each subsequent year, another 10% decrease would be required and would continue as long as necessary to bring the budget back into balance. This would mean there would be no sacred cows and no sparing of entitlements. No politician, agency, or special interest group could cry foul. Government agencies would either have to become much more efficient, cut benefits, or both. And those in charge of each governmental department should have the best idea of where the excess fat is and how to cut in the least painful manner. Since the axe would fall equally on everyone, no one could claim that they were being unfairly targeted. And we could eliminate the political overtones and get down to business. It is often easier to understand the insight logic brings to a situation by choosing a smaller and simpler problem to solve. If a family of seven, consisting of a father, mother, and five children, experienced a substantial financial setback, many lifestyle changes would have to take place. One of the changes might be the weekly allowance. I think all of the children would understand if their parents announced that, due to budgetary constraints, instead of getting $10 a week, they would only receive $9 a week. And that if things did not change, further reductions of allowance might occur in the future. Although none of the children would be happy about this change, they would be satisfied that everyone had shared equally in the sacrifice. On the other hand, if the parents decided that two of the children really were too important to have to suffer a reduction in allowance, the other three siblings would protest that they were being treated unfairly and fights might break out. There are a whole host of other issues we could discuss and problems we could solve by applying logic and fairness, and discuss and solve them we must, for our solutions to today's problems have significant ramifications for tomorrow. Our problems are not ours alone. We share them with future generations, and we have a moral obligation to hand our nation over to our children and grandchildren in good shape. If this task sounds impossible, I assure you that we can easily accomplish it if we are willing to embrace our United States Constitution and the principles put forth by the founders who took their bearings from the Word of God. Short-term, politically expedient fixes and morality are frequently incompatible. And moral values will only become a part of all our policies when we are willing to rediscover and embrace the principles that established our Constitution. Morality, of course, must be based on something, and we in America have the luxury of freely deciding what that is. Although our founders felt quite comfortable with the Bible as their guidepost, we must now decide what constitutes the foundation of our morality today. Without a moral basis for the way we conduct ourselves, our values will continue to deteriorate, and with them, our country's prosperity. We have made mistakes. However, there is always time to learn from them, change our direction, and move toward a better way. Chapter 8. Learning from Our Mistakes. Every person makes mistakes, so it should come as no surprise that every nation of the world has made mistakes as well. Talk with a German national about the hope their country placed in Hitler's rise to power on the heels of the Great Depression, or consider our own nation's internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, and you'll agree that the question is not whether a nation makes mistakes. The question is whether a nation learns from its mistakes, builds on that knowledge it gains over time, and grows in wisdom. Those nations who learn from their mistakes will become wise, while those who repeat the same mistakes over and over again, expecting a different result, are foolish. I certainly experienced my share of mistakes growing up. Because of the racial and socioeconomic injustice I experienced as a boy, in my anger and frustration, I began to retaliate by going after people with baseball bats, rocks, and knives. One day a boy pushed me too far. I told him to back off, but he wouldn't quit pestering me. Finally, I pulled out a knife and lunged at him, striking him in the abdomen. He fell back, and for a moment I thought I had killed him, but just then my knife blade fell to the ground. It had hit his belt buckle and snapped in two. I ran into the bathroom and locked myself in, terrified that I had just tried to kill someone, and over something so trivial. If his belt buckle had not been there, I would have seriously injured or killed him, and I would have been on my way to reform school or jail, following the path of so many around me. All of my life, I had attended church services, and I knew, at least in theory, that God could radically change a person's life for the better. I also knew that I had tried to gain control of my temper time after time with repeated failure. Although I was only 14 years old, I was familiar with behavioral modification therapy from reading Psychology Today, but I was also acutely aware that we had no money for behavioral modification therapy. By that time, I was a straight-A student, yet I recognized that I would never achieve my dreams of becoming a physician as long as I harbored an uncontrollable temper. So I fell to my knees there on the bathroom floor, pleading with God to remove my temper. There was a Bible in the bathroom, and I opened it to the book of Proverbs. Verses about anger and the folly of a fool's actions all seemed written to me and about me. Other verses encouraged me, such as Proverbs 16:32, which says that mightier is the man who can control his temper than the man who can conquer a city. I stayed in that bathroom for 3 hours, reading, contemplating, and praying. My selfishness had made me so angry inside, and it dawned on me that if I could just step outside myself and look at things from someone else's point of view, I might see the world differently and not feel so persecuted. My new, God-given perspective worked like a charm. He became very real to me that day, and I have never had another angry outburst of uncontrollable temper since then. There would be other tests, of course, and I would make my share of mistakes. But that, after all, is how we learn and grow. My high school, Southwestern High School in Detroit, was not particularly well known for its academics, but it was a football and basketball powerhouse. It won several state basketball championships, and you reached the pinnacle of respect among your peers if you were a starter on one of the varsity sports teams. The only other way to gain recognition was to join a successful singing group. Since we were located in Motown, students always expected one of the groups to make it big. I was definitely not one of the cool guys, however. They always wore the latest fashions, knew the latest jams on the radio, sported a nice car, and had three chicks on each arm. They also had a distinctive walk known as the Detroit Strut, and an ever-changing lingo that denoted how hip they were. I, on the other hand, was a total nerd, complete with stacks of books, thick glasses, a slide rule, and clean but dated clothing. I had neither a car nor a girlfriend. Nevertheless, I was certain I would make my mark in the world, because I was going to be so smart that everyone was going to have to take notice of me. But all I really got during my freshman year was ridicule, and I began to feel very out of place. By the time my sophomore year rolled around, I was ready to abandon my nerdy appearance and become one of the cool guys. I began to play basketball late into the night, and more disturbingly, I began grumbling constantly to my mother about my uncool clothing. My mother was very disappointed that I had lost my way and was heading in the same direction as all the people she characterized as losers. Despite her arguments, I complained incessantly. One day, during one of our arguments, she thrust at me all the money she had made scrubbing floors and cleaning toilets and said in frustration, "You pay the bills, you buy the food, you pay the rent and take care of all the other necessities. With all the money you have left over, feel free to buy all the cool clothes you want." I was thrilled, because I figured I was finally going to have my way and become one of the cool guys. As I started allocating money for all the expenses, however, I quickly ran out. I soon realized that my mother was a financial genius to somehow keep us fed and sheltered. I felt like a total fool, and sheepishly returned the money to her. I never complained about my clothing again. Fortunately, having read the Bible over the preceding years, I quickly recognized that my desire to be a part of the in crowd was more characteristic of a fool than a person of accomplishment. During my slide into foolishness, my grades had slipped precipitously, and I was horrified as I looked in the mirror and realized what I was becoming. I immediately corrected my course, abandoning my desire to be one of the cool guys. I once again became a diligent student, and my grades dramatically improved. From that day forward, I was never again tempted to abandon my long-term goals for the sake of momentary acceptance. The excitement I had experienced as a freshman in high school was nothing compared to the exhilaration I felt at becoming a Yale man. Going from inner-city Detroit to the ivy-covered walls of Yale was certainly a culture shock. Rich wood paneling covering the dining hall walls, the plates were real china, and the eating utensils were real silver. Works of art adorned the walls, and oriental rugs covered the hardwood floors. I had gone from dire poverty to the lap of luxury overnight, and I intended to enjoy every minute of it. Obtaining top grades in high school had been a snap. The material was so easy I could study for half an hour before an exam and still get an A. I naturally assumed I could do the same thing at Yale, so I took judo classes, played ping pong and table soccer, watched television, attended live entertainment events, and generally had fun. I thought I had corrected my academic flaws in high school, but but academic success in a high-powered university obviously required significantly more correction than I had accomplished. By midterm, I began to worry a bit because I wasn't doing well in some classes, including freshman chemistry, which was a prerequisite for those planning to go to medical school. My concern wasn't enough to stop me from having fun, but it did dampen my enthusiasm. By the time final exams rolled around, however, my grade in chemistry was so low, I would have failed the course even if I had gotten an A on the final exam. In an act of great compassion, or sadism, I'm not sure which, the chemistry professor offered to give anyone who was failing the course double credit for the final exam, which gave me one last glimmer of hope. I suspect he believed that people like me had no chance of passing the final exam if they had done so poorly throughout the course of the semester. Therefore, there was little or no risk in making such an offer. The night before the final exam, I sat in my room with my thick chemistry textbook, a barrier to all my hopes and dreams. I poured out my heart to God, asking forgiveness for squandering such a wonderful educational opportunity. I asked him to show me what he really wanted me to do with my life, since I obviously wasn't going to get into medical school. Preferably, I asked him to work a miracle, as I tried futilely to memorize my entire chemistry textbook. I fell asleep and entered a dream. During that dream, I was the only student in a large auditorium, and a nebulous figure was writing out chemistry problems on the chalkboard. I awakened early that morning with a dream so vivid in my mind that I quickly consulted my chemistry textbook to corroborate what I had seen in the dream. When I opened the test booklet the next day, during the chemistry final exam, I was flabbergasted when I recognized each of the problems in the booklet as one of the problems that the nebulous figure was working out on the chalkboard in my dream. It felt like I was in the twilight zone as I hurriedly scribbled down the answers, afraid that I would forget them if I waited too long. I knew the moment I finished the exam that God had granted me my miracle. I promised God that he would never have to do such a thing for me again, and that I would become a diligent student and make him proud of me. It was a scary lesson to learn, but it profoundly changed my attitude about my purpose in college. The rest of my time at Yale was relatively smooth sailing, but medical school was another matter. The amount of new material that must be mastered in medical school is equivalent to learning several foreign languages simultaneously, and many students flunked out before the first year was over. I learned my lesson in college and was very diligent about studying and attending all my lectures, but I still did horribly on the first set of comprehensive examinations. As a result, I was required to see my counselor who had been assigned by the university to help me get through medical school. He told me that I should simply drop out of medical school since I obviously wasn't cut out for medicine. Of course, I was crushed, because the only career I had aspired to since I was 8 years old was that of a physician. Following that meeting, I returned to my apartment and again poured out my heart to God, begging for wisdom. As I prayed, a thought occurred to me. What kind of courses have you always struggled with, I asked myself, and what kind of courses have given you no difficulty? It dawned on me that I did very well in courses that required a lot of reading, and I struggled in courses in which the material was communicated through boring lectures. Unfortunately, I was being subjected to 6 to 8 hours of boring lectures every day in medical school. Right there and then, I made an executive decision to skip the boring lectures and to spend that time reading. It was a risky move, but if it didn't yield results, I would have been in no worse shape than I was in already. It turned out to be a fabulously successful strategy, and the rest of medical school was a snap. That traumatic episode taught me how important it was to learn your own strengths and weaknesses from your mistakes. Over the subsequent years, I have saved enormous time and effort by understanding that I gain nothing from listening to boring lectures. I did learn that I respond well to visual input, such as reading books, viewing images, and using flashcards. I'm convinced that much of the success I have experienced in my life is a result of learning from my failures. Lessons from our mistake of allowing slavery. Of all the mistakes our nation has engaged in, allowing the practice of slavery was obviously one of our most egregious. I have found that when I extol the virtues of our nation, particularly on college campuses, the question of slavery frequently comes up, and this, of course, casts a huge shadow on many of the outstanding accomplishments of our leaders over the course of our nation's history. I doubt that there are many people today who would try to justify slavery, and it's safe to say there is a general agreement that it was an abomination. But what did we learn from this mistake? I hope we learned that all men are indeed created equal, and that given proper opportunities, not only can they improve their personal lot in life, but through the development of their intellect, they can make substantial contributions to society at large. In the case of African Americans, all you have to do is open your eyes to see the many contributions they have made to the welfare of our nation. When you see a light, for instance, you may think of Thomas Edison, but it was his right-hand man, Louis Latimer, an African American, who developed an improved filament and casing for the light bulb, allowing it to function for more than 2 or 3 days. He also invented the electric lamp, did pioneering work in incandescent lighting, and diagrammed the telephone for Alexander Graham Bell, among other things. The modern traffic signal was invented by Garrett Morgan, an African American who also invented the gas mask, which saved many lives during wars. From the potato chip to the ironing board, from refrigeration systems to sound equipment such as the microphone chip, many items that we use on a regular basis were invented by African American individuals who were once relegated simply to the role of slave. If we as a nation learn the inherent value of every citizen, our policies will strive to cultivate that talent to benefit us all. The fact that we have not recognized a high school dropout failure rate of 20-30% as a national disaster shows that we have yet to fully comprehend the value of each individual. Not only are we failing to reap substantial benefits from these individuals, but in many cases, we are actually depleting our coffers by paying for them in the penal system or the welfare system. Any one of these young people with proper encouragement and education could potentially come up with innovative products or helpful services. But because of our history of segregation, Jim Crowism, and racism, generations of African Americans have grown up with a sense of alienation toward their own country. This has created extreme levels of cynicism and distrust among many citizens who might otherwise have been enthusiastic supporters of the nation. I have heard it said that everybody harbors some degree of racism, but my own observations have led me to believe that individuals who are well-educated and who think deeply about matters tend to not base any biases on superficial characteristics. Such people tend to realize that it is the brain that makes the person who they are, not the external covering. People who are less intellectually sophisticated tend to allow their emotions to be affected by very superficial things, such as skin color. Unfortunately, basing one's ideas and opinions on superficial traits is rather common in places where intellectual development is not highly rewarded or praised. I suspect that if one did an in-depth study of people who arbitrarily engage in racial bias, they would find that such people were also attracted to visually appealing but unhealthy foods. They might be more inclined to go for the flashy red car than the dull gray hybrid that gets 50 miles to a gallon of gasoline. These people come in all sizes, colors, shapes, and socioeconomic categories. And rather than shun and castigate such people, our nation's goal should be to educate them and fill in the intellectual gaps, which would improve their value both to themselves and to us all. As an intern at Johns Hopkins in 1977, I was frequently mistaken for an orderly, phlebotomist, respiratory therapist, or some position other than a doctor. For most, it was an innocent mistake. However, it would have been easy for them to notice that I had a stethoscope around my neck, or that I was in scrubs, or was wearing a white lab coat, which would have been extremely unusual for an orderly. When I would gently point out that I was a doctor, the majority of people were highly embarrassed and apologetic. I tried to alleviate their discomfort by letting them know that I was in no way offended and that I could easily have made a similar mistake. I never encountered anyone who made the same mistake twice. I helped eliminate their social ignorance, which I'm sure was beneficial to them in the long run. Still shaking shallow, racist thinking. Although much overt racism has been eliminated in America, there are still too many people who make sweeping generalizations about whole groups of people based on a negative encounter with a person of a different race. In order to resolve this problem, we must first admit that it exists even in our own families or ourselves, and African Americans are just as likely to harbor racist attitudes as white people. Just prior to the last presidential election, when the first African American was elected president of the United States, I saw on television a segment where a reporter was interviewing African Americans in Harlem, New York, about various policies advocated by candidate Barack Obama. All of the interviewees enthusiastically supported each policy discussed without knowing that they were actually the policies held by candidate John McCain. The most hilarious part of the interviews occurred when the people were asked what they thought about Senator Obama's choice of his running mate, Sarah Palin. The answers were all quite favorable toward Governor Palin because she was picked, they thought, by Obama. Many African Americans voted for Obama simply because he was a black man and not because he resonated philosophically with his policies. If the situation were reversed and white people were obviously voting for their candidate based on race and not political philosophy, shouts of racism would be deafening. I do, however, understand the enormous pride African Americans have because the President of the United States is a black man. I even know staunchly conservative African Americans who voted for Obama even though they vehemently opposed his political platform. One individual told me that it wasn't really racism, but rather just a matter of being overwhelmed by emotion upon entering the voting booth. But racism is a subset of hatred, which also is an emotion. I'm sure many white voters were overwhelmed by emotion several years ago during California's 1982 race for governor, when they couldn't bring themselves to vote for Tom Bradley, who was the mayor of Los Angeles at the time and happened to be an African American. All the pre-election polls showed Bradley far ahead of his white opponent, and it was a foregone conclusion that he was going to win and become California's first African-American governor. But when it came time to cast votes, sentiment swung radically in the other direction. Voting for Barack Obama simply because he is black is just as irrational and racist as not voting for Tom Bradley because he was black. As a nation, we must first admit that we have a problem with racism and shallow thinking, and we need to redouble our efforts to learn from the ugly episodes in our history and move forward, united, to tackle real problems. Compounding our mistakes financially. Because President Obama is an African American who believes in redistributing wealth, white people might wonder if all or most black people are like President Obama and want to redistribute wealth. However, I personally know many African Americans who vigorously disagree with the concept of government redistribution of wealth. They love this country and have put forth a great deal of physical and intellectual effort to succeed in our nation. They share the same values as the majority of Americans and believe that they should be able to keep or distribute their resources as they see fit. When the government becomes large and intrusive and feels that it has the right to as much of the resources owned by the people as it wants, then we have clearly strayed away from some of the foundational principles of this nation. What is truly amazing is how accepting most Americans are of this government intrusion into our lives and bank accounts. It is commonplace today to find large groups of people who believe the government has a responsibility to take care of all the basic necessities of its citizens. Benjamin Franklin, however, wrote, "To relieve the misfortunes of our fellow creatures is concurring with the deity. It is godlike. But if we provide encouragement for laziness and supports for folly, may we not be found fighting against the order of God and nature, which perhaps has appointed want and misery as the proper punishments for and cautions against, as well as necessary consequences of, idleness and extravagance? Whenever we attempt to amend the scheme of providence and to interfere with the government of the world, we had need be very circumspect, lest we do more harm than good." In this passage, and in many of his other writings, Franklin makes it clear that kindness and charity are admirable traits, but that it is actually destructive to continually support the needs and habits of those who are lazy and irresponsible. By doing so, we only encourage the proliferation of these undesirable traits and the numbers of people who have to be supported. Samuel Adams went right to the heart of the matter when he said, "The utopian schemes of leveling, redistribution, and the community of goods, the government owns everything, are as visionary and impracticable as those which vest all property in the crown." These ideas he even called unconstitutional. I believe we are in the process right now of learning that our government is far too big, and the bigger it gets, the more taxpayer money it needs to sustain itself. A gigantic, bloated government has to keep itself busy in order to justify its existence. Hence, you have more regulations and meddling in the affairs of the people, whether they request it, need it, or not. Our government is now so large and expensive that each year our national debt grows larger. Currently, it sits between 14 and 15 trillion, a number that is so large that it is virtually incomprehensible. That comes out to $50,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. It was obviously a mistake to allow our government to reach this size and to spend as much as it has. But it is not the fault of one party or the other. Rather, It is the natural tendency of government to expand if there is no conscientious effort to keep it under control. The Constitution of the United States was written in such a way as to restrain government growth and power if there was a will to adhere to it. But unfortunately, many of our legislators feel that the Constitution is outdated and largely irrelevant to today's society. They feel that we have advanced far beyond the understanding of the Founding Fathers, and that through appropriate government, we can create a better life for everyone. They may be right, but I doubt it. The reason I'm skeptical that we need a new government is that the old government worked so well. Our early limited government provided an atmosphere that encouraged productivity and innovation, resulting in the most rapid expansion of a powerful middle class that the world had ever seen. It resulted in enormous economic and industrial power, as well as an extremely educated populace. If you have something that works, why change it? Is there a logical solution for controlling the size of our government and the resulting size of our national deficit? Currently, the debate is raging in Washington between the Republicans, who have been largely co-opted by the Tea Party, and the Democrats, who are finding it very difficult to break out of their tax and spend mode. The Democrats accuse Republicans of draconian budget cuts that would take food out of the mouths of babies and shelter from the elderly. At the same time, the Republicans accuse the Democrats of having no concern for our future generations and no understanding of the concept of budgetary constraints. Who is right and who is wrong in this exaggerated tug of war is not nearly as important as how to solve the problem. The problem is our mistake of permitting a bloated government bureaucracy that requires unimaginable amounts of money to sustain itself. And our problem is magnified by numerous special interest groups advocating to protect their pet programs from a reduction in government spending. As a nation, we have become so accustomed to ever-rising taxes that the fact that the government takes up to half of all one's income does not really faze many people anymore. Our government would do well to remember that one of the major reasons for the Revolutionary War was excessive taxation. I will admit to making a very good living, and I am grateful to live in this country and to have been afforded the opportunity to obtain a first-rate education and pursue the career of my choosing. However, my biggest expense by far is taxes. Between federal, state, local, sales, and real estate taxes, more than half of my income goes to pay taxes. Since that is the case, you might say that I work for the government. This is certainly not the kind of situation that was envisioned by the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers on Financial Responsibility. It is clear from the writings of our Founding Fathers that they disagreed with such excessive taxation to redistribute wealth. In the Annals of Congress, House of Representatives, 3rd Congress, 1794, President James Madison is documented as saying he could not undertake to lay his finger on that article in the Federal Constitution which granted a right to Congress of expending on objects of benevolence the money of their constituents. We all want to be benevolent, of course. But as President Madison pointed out, there is nothing in the Constitution that entitles the government to use the money of their constituents for charitable purposes, no matter how noble their goals. His quote should be read every day to members of our current Congress, particularly those who complain about restraining the sacred entitlements to which our population has become addicted. Again, our goal should be to reinstill a sense of independence and self-reliance in all of our citizens, while continuing to cultivate caring and compassion for our neighbors who cannot take care of themselves. Thomas Jefferson, an incredible visionary, made it clear that the accumulation of huge debt by the government is not only unacceptable, but dangerous to the preservation of our nation. He said, "I, however, place economy among the first and most important virtues, and public debt as the greatest of dangers to be feared." He also said, "To preserve their independence, we must not let our rulers load us with perpetual debt." It almost seems as if he had the ability to look into the future and recognize the natural consequences of ever-growing and unrestrained government. The principle of spending money to be paid by posterity, he added, under the name of funding, is but swindling futurity on a large scale. Many voices today decry the accumulation of debt we're passing on to the next generation, but their protest are falling on many deaf ears among our leaders in government. But it is this statement that has been attributed to Jefferson that is especially alarming given the stated goals of the current administration to redistribute wealth. The democracy will cease to exist when you take away from those who are willing to work and give to those who would not. Even though there was no record of Jefferson actually saying that, I believe the statement is right, whoever said it. I hope this quote shakes you to the core, as it does me, and that you will realize how far we have strayed from the ideas of those who founded our nation and set it on a course of unparalleled success. Jefferson was not alone in his views, and even some of his political foes embraced the ideas that are paramount to protecting our liberties and the prosperity of our nation. James Madison said, "If Congress can employ money indefinitely to the general welfare, the powers of Congress would subvert the very foundation, the very nature, of the limited government established by the people of America." John Adams even appealed the matter to higher spiritual realities when he said, "The moment the idea is admitted into society that property is not as sacred as the laws of God, and that there is not a force of law and public justice to protect it, anarchy and tyranny commence." Would applying logic help in solving this problem of taxation? Certainly, there have been many different schemes devised by mankind throughout history to impose and collect taxes. There is, however, only one tax imposed by God, and that is the tithe, which is one-tenth of your salary. Interestingly, God did not say if you have a bumper crop that you should give triple tithes. Nor did he say if your crops fail, you are entitled to a reduction in tithes or need to pay no tithes at all. This means that there is fairness in proportionality. If you make $10 billion a year, your tax or tithe would be $1 billion. Whereas if your income is $10 a year, you would pay $1. Some would say that the billionaire is not hurt by his $1 billion contribution as much as the poor man who had to give up a dollar. They would say that the pain is not proportional and that the government has the right to decide how much more the rich man should pay. But where in God's law does it say that the rich man needs to give until it hurts? He just put $1 billion into the common pot, so why do we need to hurt him? It is this kind of thinking that has led to the proliferation of offshore bank accounts. If we had a proportional tax system, there would be no significant incentive for people to hide their money, and they could spend more time concentrating on production, which in the long run would lead to even more money for the government. What about creating an atmosphere that encourages businesses to not hide their money, but to invest it back into the company, to expand it, and provide more jobs? Our corporate tax rate is one of the highest in the world. The only country with a high corporate tax rate like ours is Japan, which just so happens to also be the only country with a greater debt-to-GDP ratio than we have. Is that coincidence or evidence of cause and effect? I suspect the latter.